Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Grateful to... Can everyone hear this all right? Okay.
Yeah.
I still owe Father Landry a couple for his great Scavi tour he gave me in Rome in 2000. Okay, well, I begin with something on the introduction to the encyclical. I want to speak this afternoon about what might be called the exegesis of Pope Benedict's encyclical. The encyclical is written with much care. It's the sort of document that repays careful attention. One of my professors in graduate school, Hilary Putnam, said that the mark of a great philosopher is that the smarter you get, the smarter he gets. I suppose it's a sign of an inspired text, such as the Gospels, that the holier a person gets, the better the text instructs for holiness. But something similar, I think, is seen in the writings of the Holy Father, who is at the same time, besides Pope, a man of prayer and a theologian. It's not that his writings are inspired, of course, but still, I think we can be confident that if we approach them with docility and care, we will always find something there that corresponds to our efforts. That holds especially, I think, of the current document, which, as I'm sure other speakers have mentioned, has a special significance because it is the first encyclical of the Pope's pontificate. It therefore is programmatic, as Redemptor Hominis was for John Paul II. What is the program? Nothing completely new, of course, since that was set down for the millennium in Novo Millennium Ineunte. But still, we can be sure it is something new for the here and now. A good scribe in the kingdom of heaven brings forth from his storehouse things both new and old. These reflections are reinforced by the Pope's own understanding of the encyclical along these lines. The first part of the encyclical, he says, and that's the part I shall be discussing, not the second part, is more speculative. Since I wanted here, he says, at the beginning of my pontificate, to clarify some essential facts concerning the love which God mysteriously and gratuitously offers to man, together with the intrinsic link between that love and the reality of human love. The Pope says that he wants to clarify some essential facts. Actually, what he says is that he wants to precepua ex stolera, to draw attention to fundamental principles. He's teaching us, reminding us, and pointing the way. He wishes to do so, as he says, concerning the love which God mysteriously and gratuitously offers to man. That phrase, mysteriously and gratuitously, this is in the third quotation on the handout, is arcana gratuitaque ratione, that is, in a hidden, deep, unsearchable, secret manner, and as a free gift. But I go to the Latin in these phrases because I think they reveal one of the most important messages of the encyclical a bit better than the translation in this case, which I think has been missed by many reports on it. The love of God, Pope Benedict wants to tell us, is a mystery. It is a mystery in the strict sense, in the way in which the great truths of the faith, such as the Trinity and Incarnation, are mysteries. A mystery is difficult to understand and can even seem to involve incompatible realities. And yet no contradiction can be discovered in it, and we come to understand it progressively through a kind of journey which presupposes faith, faith seeking understanding. Benedict also wishes to stress, at the same time, as he says, the intrinsic link between that love and the reality of human love. Now, the original Latin for this phrase, the reality of human love, is humani amoris natura, strictly the nature of human love. And that's a better translation, I think, since the word nature conveys first that human love has a character that cannot be altered or shaped by human convention, and second, that it has this character as a consequence of God's creation. Now, put these two ideas together. First, that God's love is a mystery. Second, that human love is inherently bound up with God's love. And then one arrives at a startling result. Namely, that there is for us, in effect, simply one love, and that love is either itself a mystery, or it leads directly and inevitably into a mystery. Again, using that word mystery in its strict theological sense. This, I think, is actually a revolutionary idea, and quite at odds with how we tend to think about love, for three basic reasons. The first is that if love is a mystery, then it needs an appropriate span of time for its expression. Our culture, in contrast, tends to think of love, true love, as something that can be shown and experienced quickly. In a few months, perhaps, people fall in love, and then perhaps they fall out of love, supposing, after the fact, that they had reached the pinnacle of love in those first few weeks or months of intensity. And yet, if love is a mystery, it cannot be so. One could not have possessed love in a few months. If love is a mystery, then the appropriate span of time for progressing in our understanding of it is a lifetime. A lifetime in marriage or in celibate service to God. The second remarkable consequence that follows simply from the consideration that love is a mystery is that we really don't comprehend it. We can't grasp it. And what we do grasp, we can be sure is not love. I mean comprehend in the literal sense that we can't, that we are getting around it completely, wrapping our minds around it, as we say. Love cannot be figured out. It needs to be rediscovered constantly. When St. John says, "He who abides in love abides in God," we shouldn't understand this as love is staying put and we need to stay where love is. Rather, it's love is moving onward, and we have to keep moving forward through a constant process of conversion at God's pace. Otherwise, we won't remain in it. The third remarkable consequence is that we should not speak so much of God's love or human love, but simply love. There is for us one love only, no dualisms of love. It is clear in Benedict's encyclical that he regards this as a consequence of the Incarnation. Deus Caritas Est is a deeply incarnational encyclical, just as Redemptor Hominis was. One may express this unity in various ways, that we love with a single heart, just as Christ loved with a single heart, or insofar as love departs from love of God, then it is no longer love. Or, as in the beginning of the encyclical, eros without agape is not love, and surprisingly, agape without eros is not love. Again, one may speak of the analogy of love, that there is an important sense, there is an important sense in which all loves are the same. The love of a celibate priest, if it is true love, is the same love as a married man. It is not the case that the one involves the denial, suppression, avoidance, or departure from the love involved in the other. Note that when we say that love is a mystery and is unified, we do not mean that this is so for Christians only. Pope Benedict very much writes in the spirit of the incarnational humanism of the Second Vatican Council and John Paul II. He presupposes that the Incarnation has changed all of human experience, human history, and human reality. There is not one way for a Christian to remain in love and another way for a Muslim to remain in love. The Christian way, admittedly in all its fullness as a truly human way, is the only way for all human beings. Although, to be sure, non-Christians may worship a God they do not know, or serve a God in which they live and move and have their being, but do not acknowledge properly. Pope Benedict's mind is very careful and orderly. He tells us what he wants to hold up for our consideration, fundamental principles of love. He tells us that these principles include that God's love is a mystery, that it is a free gift, that it is intrinsically linked to human nature and human love. But he also tells us two other things. He tells us first the order in which he's going to discuss these things at the first part of the encyclical, and this is the opening words, my quotation one on the handout. God is love, the encyclical begins, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. These words from the first letter of John express with remarkable clarity the heart of the Christian faith, the Christian image of God, and the resulting image of mankind and its destiny. The three topics of the first part of the encyclical are then, first, the Christian image of God as love, that is, the analogies and depictions of God that Christians accept, and especially the full revelation of this in Christ. Second, the resulting, or better, matching, corresponding, congruentum, image of human nature. That is, what we are like, given that our Creator and Redeemer is love, as so revealed. And third, the destiny, or better, journey, the way, the Latin word is related to itinerary, that we need to take, given what God is like, and depart, and given our nature. Pope Benedict identifies this way with Christ. He is our way in the mystery of love. The other thing that he does, and he tells us at the start, is to tell us the spirit in which this is carried out. That this is not a theoretical investigation. This is not a matter of understanding something intellectually. As he says near the beginning of the encyclical, Christianity involves at the start an acknowledgement of an event and the recognition of a person with whom we want to have a relationship of love. So that's the opening, the proemium of the encyclical. The next part, I think, should be called the foundation of the encyclical. Before going on to speak of the Christian image of God as love, Pope Benedict first sets down some things about eros and agape as a preliminary. This is probably the part of the encyclical that has received the most attention, deservedly so, because one of the things that it does, and this may seem shocking, is to propose that eros, erotic love, literally, although that would be a misleading translation of it, not for ancient philosophers, by the way. All the time we talk about Plato's eroticism, and we understand it in a very technical way. It's to propose that eros, erotic love, is inseparable from agape. Benedict points out that agape is the preferred word for love in the New Testament, and that eros, favored by classical writers, is almost absent. Doesn't this open up Christianity to the charge that it concentrates on only one aspect of love, that it neglects or even suppresses an entire side of human nature? There are two scholarly studies along these lines that were almost certainly in the Pope's thoughts when he wrote this section. One is called Eros and Agape by Anders Nygren, a Lutheran bishop, theologian, and historian of ideas, in which Nygren postulates an absolute distinction between eros and agape. And that distinction is expressed in the chart that you have on your handout. Eros on the left, agape on the right. Eros is based on need. It's a possessive love. It's what C.S. Lewis calls in his little book on the four loves, need love. Someone who loves in this way out of eros is essentially selfish, Nygren thinks, because he aims at his own fulfillment. At best, people who have eros can go out of themselves through reciprocity. This is when each helps another person reach his own each helps another reach his own satisfaction. Reciprocity is simply cooperative self-seeking. I scratch your back, and you scratch mine. Some other features of eros which are mentioned by the Pope, it comes to us, apparently unplanned. It draws us upwards. It's an ascending love. It causes, classically, ecstasy, a kind of going out of oneself. And yet, at the same time, it's vulnerable to degradation. Agape, in contrast, is thought to originate in fullness, not need. It finds its expression not in reciprocity or possessiveness, but rather in free giving. Instead of being egoistic, it's altruistic. Instead of coming to us, it is deliberate and freely willed. Instead of going upwards, it goes downwards. It shows condescension. It brings us out of ourselves in some way, but not through ecstasy, but rather by identification, solidarity. And whereas Eros is vulnerable to degradation, on this view, agape is protected from that because it's essentially self-sacrificial. Nigrin agrees with the charge that Christianity rejects Eros, but he thinks that this is a good thing because Eros is selfish and not truly love. In contrast, he says, what Christianity discovered, so to speak, and contributed to the world was a new sort of love, an entirely disinterested love. This is the love by which God condescends to become human and then freely gives up his life, gaining nothing from it in the bargain. He in whom the fullness of deity was pleased to dwell regarded equality with God as not something to be grasped at. Notice that Nigrin's view is strongly dualistic. Nigrin condemns nearly all expressions of human love as self-seeking. Divine love, in contrast, comes to us as something almost alien and contrary to our natural inclinations. A second scholarly discussion, which was also surely in the Pope's thoughts when he wrote his encyclical, is a book called Love in the Western World by Denis de Rougemont. This book also postulates a dualism between Eros and Agape, but with a tragic thesis. According to de Rougemont, human beings are by nature beings who love with Eros as well as Agape. But the stability of society and Christian morality requires that this be denied, in a sense. So Christian society promotes stable and monogamous marriages, but these tend not to be satisfying. They correspond to simply one aspect of human nature. Thus, de Rougemont says, through the history of the world, even men in stable marriages have typically had relationships marked by erotic or romantic love with women other than their wives. Wives have been thought of as for bearing and raising children and for keeping a house. But mistresses and paramours are for love. If there has been a double standard and men more than women have had love relationships on the side, that is only because men have had more opportunity and power to do this, and perhaps also because they are less sensitive to the effects of these relationships on social structures. Now, I say we can be confident that these books are in his mind because these books have been studied for decades among the communio crowd, people interested in personalism and theology of the body and philosophy and theology of love and marriage. They've been understood to be throwing down a challenge, so to speak. Benedict, however, does not refer explicitly to either Nigrin or de Rougemont, but he does refer to the 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, probably because Nietzsche was a deeper thinker, saw the tensions and dualisms later described by Nigrin and de Rougemont, and concluded from this that Europe's adoption of Christianity was a mistake and should be abandoned in favor of a kind of return to paganism. Nietzsche was not optimistic, however, that his brand of paganism could keep Europe from sinking into nihilism, the view that ultimately nothing exists and nothing has a purpose. It's appropriate, then, for Benedict to cite Nietzsche, because Benedict, as we know, is concerned with the re-evangelization of Europe, and Nietzsche foreshadowed and captures so well the malaise of contemporary Europe. Against the views of Nigrin and de Rougemont, Pope Benedict argues that Eros and Agape are not at odds with each other. He teaches that, as a matter of Christian anthropology and ethics, Eros, to be true to and to preserve what it is, must have the character of Agape, and Agape, similarly, depends upon Eros. You'll note that this manner of argument is frequently used in the teachings of the Church. John Paul II argued that way in his encyclical Fides et Ratio. He compares faith and reason to wings of a bird. Each depends upon the other. Neither works well on its own. John Paul II also famously changed the terms of the contraception debate in this way. Before his pontificate, it was common, even for defenders of the Church's teaching, to conceive that contraceptive sexual relations contributed to marital unity and intimacy, even if the use of contraception was intrinsically wrong. And then some dissenters would hold that the end could justify the means in extreme or desperate cases. John Paul II changed all of this through his catechetical addresses on the theology of the body and humanae vitae. He argued that the procreative and unitive effects of sexual relations formed an inseparable whole. If you tried to take the one simply on its own, you would lose the other as well. Contraceptive sex, therefore, is not unitive sex. And his argument has by now been amply confirmed by the social effects of contraception, such as increasing divorce rates and same-sex marriage. Perhaps the reason this form of argument recurs in Church teaching is that the mutual dependence of things is what one would expect if creation is the action of a provident God who takes apparently different forces and reconciles them in composing complex systems. It's as though one were to argue the lungs will not work apart from the heart, and the heart will not work apart from the lungs. Obviously so. What's obviously in the case of the body, however, is not always so clear in the case of morality for us fallen beings. In any case, Pope Benedict puts forward the same sort of argument as regards eros and agape. First, he considers eros. Suppose it is taken on its own. Suppose people who experience it want to keep it as it is when they first experience it. Note that this would be to deny that it is a mystery. It would be to deny that this is the sort of love we need to remain in by constant conversion. But then, Benedict says, it inevitably becomes degraded. His argument for this is largely empirical. Just look, he says, at how people end up acting when they go down this path. They want to keep eros as it is, precisely because it seems to summon us from without and promise us deep happiness through a kind of ecstasy. That is, it presents an aspect of the divine to us. If we try to keep it as we first experience it, this divine thing, that is to idolize it. We treat it as an idol. It is a creature that nonetheless we regard this just on its own as a divine thing. But then we end up subjecting and abasing ourselves to it. That's just what human beings do with any creature they regard as divine. It is impossible to serve both God and mammon. Either you love the one and reject the other, or you cling to the one, that is, debase yourself in its presence and despise the other. At the same time, we find ourselves turned against the true God. The result is human misery, which Benedict, as it were, simply gestures towards with his mention of the grotesque practice of temple prostitutes. There's more than enough experience to confirm the truth that eros on its own leads to human degradation and misery. But Benedict adds to his argument the philosophical consideration that it is impossible to idolize eros except by taking our bodies to be instruments. We view ourselves as mere minds or souls, and we view our bodies as machines for serving our sexual desires and pleasures. And this kind of dualism has all kinds of other disastrous manifestations, such as abortion, in vitro fertilization, harvesting organs and stem cells, and so on. His argument, in effect, is that any way of life or practice which presupposes and fosters such a distorted vision of human nature is, on conceptual and philosophical grounds, shown to be false. Eros, therefore, cannot stand on its own. It cannot be preserved just as it is when it is first experienced. Progress and a journey are necessary here as in other areas of human life. And either we move towards degradation or we move in the other direction, toward what the Pope calls purification of the love and discipline. The Pope at this point sketches the typical stages of this process of purification, which I include on the handout. First, I'll just read them and then describe them. The acceptance of love is a journey. Second, the real discovery of the other. Third, fidelity to a sensed, real concern for the other. Fourth, the seeking of the genuine good of the beloved. Fifth, willing renunciation of one's own goods for the beloved. And sixth, seeking that the love become definitive through exclusivity and permanence. Recall that I said earlier that our encounter with a mystery implies a journey which is initiated by faith. It must always be a case of faith seeking understanding. At the beginning of the purification of Eros is an act of romantic faith, as we might call it, that the relationship is for the long haul. It is forever. The love is forever, as all lovers think. That is, before they become cynical and jaded. However, once lovers acknowledge that love is forever, then, provided that they hold true to this with their romantic faith, then they will discover, as heated emotions cool, as they inevitably must, that their initial intoxication was not love. This is the crucial first stage, the rejection of the idolatry of love, the recognition that love is other than what they took it to be, and that they have to change what they think love is if they are to keep up with this love which is forever. This clarity about themselves and their emotions then should give each lover clarity about the other. They seek for an interpretation of their love. Why did this happen to me? How did I fall in love? And here, if love is genuine eros and not a mere infatuation, they begin to discover reflectively, and in a way that can be affirmed more fully by the will, the true goodness of the other. This will be a discovery, too, that the other person's good is something distinct from one's own good. This then leads to fidelity, which may be understood as a reinterpretation now of that initial intimation of forever, but in view of the recognized genuine good of the other person. Fidelity is an act of the will of commitment without end to that other person's genuine good. But the moment we begin to look for the good of another forever, then we are forced to distinguish that person's true good from other things that are only apparently good for or good about that person. We are led to think of goods of the soul rather than goods of animal life or enjoyment. At this point, it may become clear to the two lovers that their eternal destinies are interrelated. There comes to mind that recommendation of St. John Chrysostom that a Christian man courting a Christian woman should say to her that he wishes so to live with her in this life as to share happiness with her for eternity. To someone who views things in this way, however natural it would be to renounce oneself and even die in order to benefit the other, precisely because one's destiny is eternal and in heaven. And yet now, when they view their relationship in this way, they want their earthly life to mirror, to correspond to, and match, congruere, their heavenly destiny. This then leads them to seek a definitive expression of their love, as the Pope says. They now view exclusive and permanent matrimony as the only satisfactory expression of the love that they have for each other. What I have just described is the path of two lovers who are true to their love, in the way that their love itself asks them to be true. This completes the Pope's argument that Eros requires agape. It requires it not as something imposed from without, or as an external standard that keeps it in check, rules against fooling around or sex before marriage, but as an intrinsic requirement of romantic love. Romantic love becomes love with the character of agape, because it is that in the intention of creation from the start. Now, Pope Benedict's argument that, contrariwise, agape requires eros is much briefer. He does not argue now empirically, although he might do so. he might have pointed to the coldness of those who attempt to love only with agape, and how this tends to deteriorate into even cruelty. I know not a few philosophers who are big proponents of the Kantian impersonal point of view in morality, but who also favor killing babies for convenience. The culture of death comes from detached agape, just as much as from detached eros. Or the Pope might have reminded us of the cold Pharisaism that is the result of an agape that is not humanized with eros. But the Pope gives a common sense, simple argument at this point. It's not possible, he says, to give without being replenished. He might have said here too, it would be idolatry to think otherwise, idolatry of one's own capacity for Christian love, because only a God could love without needing replenishment. That brings us to the next part of the encyclical, the Christian image of God. Perhaps a reason the Pope does not spend too much time on the argument that agape requires eros is that when he turns to discussing the Christian image of God, as found in Revelation, his main concern is to show how God displays eros, and not simply agape. Since God is our pattern for love, this then implies we must show both as well. But, to remove a possible misunderstanding, it is not as though the Pope, in saying that God shows eros as well as agape, denies or minimizes the mystery. Indeed, even in discussing human love, the Pope really does more to show that the two loves must be combined, not how they are so. We don't really explain the how simply by describing the stages by which eros is purified, any more than I explain how a child grows by merely telling about his development. That God's love should be both eros and agape is a mystery. The eros aspect is perhaps more mysterious. How can God be in need? How can God love passionately? How can God betroth a nation, such as Israel, or the church? And yet, if we think about it, the agape aspect is just as mysterious. As the psalmist long ago taught us, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou carest for him? It's easy, perhaps, to think that God loves himself with a single, eternal act of divine happiness, as Aristotle thought, but it's not so easy to understand how God loves us, even with condescending, altruistic, overflowing love. The philosophical dimension to be noted in this biblical vision, the Pope writes, and its importance from the standpoint of the history of religions, lies in the fact that, on the one hand, we find ourselves before a strictly metaphysical image of God. God is the absolute and ultimate source of all being, but this universal principle of creation, the logos, primordial reason, is at the same time a lover with all the passion of a true love. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity points out that one mark that is distinctive of Christianity, and he thinks a sign of its truth among all other religions, is that it combines together an attitude of awe commingled with fear for the supernatural, the numinous, as Carl Otto called it, with a very high moral code. And these two things don't often get combined. In fact, today we see their separation in New Age religions and the New Paganism. Pope Benedict, in the passage I just read, calls attention to another remarkable combination that is found only in Judaism and Christianity. The view of God as the providential master intellect and creator of the whole cosmos, the universal principle of creation, and yet at the same time, an insistent, persistent, dogged, unfailingly loyal lover with all the passions of a true love, as the Pope says. Lots of scientists have agreed with the famous statement of Sir James Jeans that if God exists, he is a mathematician. Christianity holds that this being, whose thoughts include the theory of fractals and vector calculus, is much more stuck on your loving him than my clingy puppy dog who follows me without much self-respect from room to room. Benedict then turns to his presentation of the image of man after considering the image of God. Remember, this is the image of man corresponding to the image of God. This too was an aspect of the encyclical that was ignored, I think, by those 10-minute critics who were asked to give their view of it when it first came out, but whose opinion has since been largely forgotten, except by me, I do research on these things. What Benedict does at this point is to move away from the classical notion that the image of God in man is the intellect and will of a single human being toward the biblical image that let us make man in our image, and in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. This is, of course, following in the footsteps of John Paul II. The image of God in man, according to the Pope, which corresponds to the mysterious union of Eros and Agape in God, is, drumroll please, the institution of marriage. If you turn, if you have a copy of the encyclical page to number 11, you can read along with me. Otherwise, I'll read it, and you can listen. Here is that remarkable passage. The first novelty of biblical faith consists, as we have seen, in its image of God. The second, essentially connected to this, is found in the image of man. The biblical account of creation speaks of the solitude of Adam, the first man, and God's decision to give him a helper. Of all other creatures, not one is capable of being the helper that man needs, even though he has assigned a name to all the wild beasts and birds and thus made them fully a part of his life. And you'll recognize here a recounting of the original solitude of man that John Paul II speaks of. So God forms woman from the rib of man. Now Adam finds the helper that he needed. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Here one might detect hints of ideas which are also found, for example, in the myth mentioned by Plato, that's in his Symposium, according to which man was originally spherical because he was complete in himself and self-sufficient, but as a punishment for his pride he was split in two by Zeus, so that now he longs for his other half, striving with all his being to possess it and thus regain his integrity. While the biblical narrative does not speak of punishment, the idea is certainly present that man is somehow incomplete, driven by nature to seek in another the part that can make him whole, the idea that only in communion with the opposite sex can he become complete. This is the spousal significance of the body of John Paul II. The biblical account thus concludes with a prophecy about Adam. Therefore, a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. The Pope continues, two aspects of this are important. First, Eros is somehow rooted in man's very nature. Adam is a seeker who abandons his mother and father, quite shocking really, in order to find woman. Only together do the two represent complete humanity and become one flesh. The second aspect is equally important. From the standpoint of creation, Eros directs man towards marriage, to a bond which is unique and definitive. Thus and only thus does it fulfill its deepest purpose. And we saw how that was worked out, that kind of logic internal to Eros. Corresponding to the image of a monotheistic God is monogamous marriage. That's his answer to the first question. What is the image of man congruent to the image of God? Marriage based on exclusive and definitive love becomes the icon of the relationship between God and his people and vice versa. God's way of loving becomes the measure of human love. This close connection between Eros and marriage in the Bible has practically no equivalent in extra-biblical literature. Now, don't let the SJC of Massachusetts read that by themselves. Then they'll conclude that this is a purely religious position. It follows from this that any attack on marriage, now this is my own writing now, it's no longer quoting Pope, it follows from this that any attack on marriage, divorce, contraception, same-sex marriage, cohabitation, is at one and the same time an attack on the image of God's love in man, the natural image of himself that God has set up in human society. I close with just a brief mention of the third topic that the Pope said he would discuss, namely man's itinerary Destiny was the kind of New Agey translation chosen by the Secretary of State, but man's itinerary back to God. This proves to be, of course, redemptor hominis. And that is why at number 12 in the encyclical, the Pope turns to Jesus Christ, the incarnate love of God. Now, two observations about this. If you have followed the Pope's homilies in the last year, you know that it is a favorite theme of his that the Eucharist is dynamic. As he understands it, the celebration of the Mass is like a ferment of spiritual energy, which is meant to energize the communicants and turn them into apostles and saints. But what is this spiritual energy? It is precisely the arcane, hidden, secret gift of God's love, a mysterious intertwining of Eros and Agape. If you will, Pope Benedict is drawing our attention to the fact that the Eucharist is erotic in the strict sense. If the theology of the body sometimes explains marital love, as it does, as an analog of Holy Communion, it is now as if the Pope is taking this comparison back in the other direction and emphasizing the passionate union and intimacy with our Lord, which the Eucharist is meant to be. Second and finally, it is in Benedict's discussion of the Eucharist as union and communion that we find the answer to a criticism sometimes raised against the encyclical, namely that although it deals with Eros and Agape, it does not deal with philia, with friendship, another one of the loves recognized classically. Isn't this a significant omission? When, after all, at the Last Supper, according to the Gospel of John, when our Lord wanted to declare the extent of his love for his disciples, he didn't say, "I call you my spouse." He didn't say, "I call you my son." He said, "I call you my friends." Of course, friendship with Christ is another great theme so far in Pope Benedict's pontificate. And we can hardly think that he would leave this out. And there it is in his discussion of the Eucharist. A friend is another self, Aristotle said, and yet that is what we become with Christ through receiving him in communion. And I'll now read two quotations from Numbers 16 and Numbers 17, respectively. And that will conclude my talk. From number 16, the unbreakable bond between love of God and love of neighbor is emphasized in the Eucharist. One is so closely connected to the other that to say that we love God becomes a lie if we are closed to our neighbor or hate him altogether. Pope Benedict is saying that the incarnation is what makes the two great commandments a single commandment. Love is never finished and complete. Throughout life, it changes and matures, and thus remains faithful to itself. Idem vela atque idem nola. To want the same thing and to reject the same thing was recognized by antiquity as the authentic content of love. Actually, it was recognized by antiquity as the authentic description of friendship. Amicitia. Idem vela atque idem nola. To want and to the same thing and to reject the same thing. The one becomes similar to the other, and this leads to a community of will and thought. The love story between God and man consists in the very fact that this communion of will increases in a communion of thought and sentiment, and thus our will and God's will increasingly coincide. God's will is no longer for me an alien will, something imposed on me from without by the commandments, but it is now my own will, based on the realization that God is in fact more deeply present to me than I am to myself. Then self-abandonment to God increases, and God becomes our joy. Thank you very much. You want to have questions? Okay.
Yeah.
40 minutes
or so for questions.
Okay, there are 40 minutes for questions.
You have to go.
No, I don't have to go, actually.
Oh,
yeah. That was canceled. Yeah, so I'm staying. Yes, in the back.
Could you expand on that, the divorce, agape,
attributes as much to the culture of death as the divorce eros. I think that's
yes, right.
Is agape being used in equivocal
sense? Agape, okay, so what is agape when it's divorced? Well, then it's no longer agape. It's it has different manifestations. The one I have in mind is where people attempt to view all humanity simply as rational persons. And so every person is equal, so it's called from the impersonal point of view, sometimes described as. It's kind of a Kantian position, so John Rawls takes this view, and Immanuel Kant did originally. Now, how does that lead to favoring baby killing? Well, because you view other human beings, so to speak, as if they were simply spirits. This is one of the great temptations in the garden, right? You are gods, to think that we're not fleshly, that we're somehow just spiritual beings, pure intellects. And then when you do that, then the question is easily, you can raise a question such as, well, is the fetus a person? In other words, does the fetus count as part of, is one of these intellects somehow in the fetus or not? That's not a question that arises if you're viewing these things from the point of view of human nature with flesh, that's one flesh with your own child. So I think the two are going together. In a certain sense, it's a kind of class-based thing, right? So in our society, you have educated classes with this impersonal point of view and deciding things from a kind of plush suburbs where they don't have to kind of mix with anyone else. And then you have a kind of, lower class, which has accepted the sexual revolution, is paying the price for it. And the two things are combining together, and you see it's this kind of split of agape, I think, and eros in an interesting way. Yeah.
God in Smith 24, which was probably one of the two most famous quotations of Pope John Paul II, man cannot discover himself except in the disinterested gift of himself to it. That's obviously true in the agapic sense, but do you think it's sufficient on the basis of what Benedict said here that agape alone doesn't cut it for man?
Okay, so the question is, and as I said, there's not a lot said in the encyclical about how agape implies eros or needs eros. So your question is, how is it that somebody who had just agape, we might reason or argue, wouldn't be so successful at making a sincere gift of himself?
It strikes me that you need to have agapic love in order to discover who you are. But I think Benedict here is saying that if all you have is agape, you're not going to truly discover who you are. That you have to have that passionate selflessness at the same time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's okay, and that's a good point. And the sincere gift of oneself is a gift also of one's body, right? So it's kind of an ablation of one's entire being. And romantic love is the obvious paradigm of this, as the Pope says, and of this kind of offering up of one's body. And Romeo and Juliet is just such a great example. What happens? They both die at the end, right? They die, and their gift of their death, their life, doesn't really amount to anything. There's no purpose for it. It's not like a soldier dying in battle, which was what makes it such a great symbol of romantic love, because they're simply dying for the other. That's all that they're doing. Each is simply dying because of the other person. So I think you could argue that there's a kind of coldness or sterility, a holding back that comes from agape, just on its own, and a large measure of self-deception. So somebody might think that he's really giving his all, and he's really not. And I think that's where hypocrisy and Pharisaism comes in, all kinds of things where we justify and explain away our love of comfort or unwillingness to make really extreme sacrifices and this kind of thing. Our lack of vision, lack of imagination, lack of daring, lack of willingness to take risks, all of these things are bound. I mean, why is St. Peter the founder of the church? Well, he's clearly, and Plato would say, he's an erotic man. Again, you have to understand this in the right way. But he is passionate. He moves quickly. He's got a temper. He's not a cold intellectual. I suppose maybe some Protestant theologians have wondered, why were these kinds of people picked out? And the Pharisees, we know, did wonder that. And the fact that they were common fishermen is itself an argument that we need eros as well as agape. Yeah.
Would the Leo then be considered
the Leo
within an imperfect form of agape, or
okay, well, I suppose we want to say they're all united. The fourth kind of love that C.S. Lewis mentions is storge. And storge is affection that you have for a trusted dog, or you come home and everything's familiar and you like to sink into your easy chair. it's like home. It's the fondness and ease you feel and affection for home and nostalgia would be thrown in there. That would be the fourth. So ultimately, I mean, I suppose one would want to, you know, add maybe storge in the encyclical somewhere, probably is. I didn't notice. But philia is certainly there. Now, you said, well, is philia subordinate to agape?